Hello, and welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber.
Welcome back to our exploration of the Anthropocene, and the debates around its definition, pronunciation, and if you ask some people, existence at all.
Before we rev back up, Anna, would you care to give us a bit of a recap from last episode?
Yes, here it is. It's not the Anthropocene, according to some geologists. And when we define, or when we seek to define the Anthropocene, we went over some of the evidence that those geologists cited and thinking about, like, when did humans really start having an impact on the planet? And so we did a little time hopping, talked about industrial archaeology briefly, and
I think
here we are.
Most crucially, we defined the Anthropocene as originally proposed by these two guys, these two
Crutzen
eminent scientists, Crutzen and Sturmer, in 2000.
Yeah, and they said sort of the past 200 years.
Yeah.
1700s.
Yeah, so with the Industrial Revolution. So we've had the Industrial Revolution, the Neolithic Revolution, but now we have the other most common contender for the start of the Anthropocene, which is the mid-20th century CE, a period called the Great Acceleration.
I don't like that. That
well,
makes
get ready.
Stressed.
You're going to not like it even more.
Yeah, I know.
So in that time, we see a growing population with exponentially increasing consumption and creation of synthetic materials. So you have organic pollutants like pollution being dumped in. Other organic, like in the chemistry sense. Microplastics from production, but also the decay of these synthetic materials. And also fly ash has been happening since the Industrial Revolution, because fly ash is something that comes from coal burning. But it also it's a byproduct of petroleum based combustion.
Okay. That was going to be my question. I don't know what fly ash is. Is it just like little bits of carbon?
It's dirt. Okay. It's the dust. It's the dust that
coal dust.
Like kind of
burning dust. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
There's a species extinction in a big way. There has been the creation of geological features that never existed before, like miles deep mines, landfill mountains, mountaintop removal mining, we've talked a little bit about the miles deep mines, but, mining has a profound impact on the environment. When they're not being used anymore, they can fill up with water and other things, and stuff can leach out and it can kill entire systems. And also like blow out the side of the mountain, fall in, things like that. But you also have these mountains of things like, things called high walls, where you have slag piles, like you have sort of, just refuse
remnants of processing.
That form
extraction.
Straight up mountains. You also have mountains of trash. And then mountaintop removal mining started in the 60s, really. And it's big in Appalachia, because we have low mountains with seams of coal that when you crunch the numbers, it is cheaper to cut the entire top of the mountain off and dump it in the valley, and just take the coal away and, leave.
And that's it.
Or, become governor later. I don't know. So these are all like pretty, these are all like the huge changes on the landscape, and you see them, and I'm just naming naming things that happen in the U.S. that has like an environmental protection agency that nominally regulates these things. The Some scale of change don't. Globally is pretty astounding and depressing. Mm-hmm. There's also nuclear fallout. That's a big one that I just have as two words, nuclear fallout.
Yep, that's enough.
You also have technofossils as a category. Technofossils can include many of the things that I mentioned here, like, you know, thinking about fly ash, microplastics. But technofossils as a term we're getting into the thinky parts that feel good to me. So these are human modified objects in the fossil record. So we're talking about the fossil record. We're talking about what, Anna?
I'm going to make that your ringtone.
Oh,
what? The thinky parts that feel good to me.
So we're moving. So we are using archaeology brain, like, and we're thinking about sort of like signatures of human behavior, like those sorts of things. But we need to, we've got to think bigger into the fossil record. And so thinking paleontologically, that there are things that are entering, that have entered the fossil record that are human made. That starts with the earliest worked stone or bone tools and goes all the way up to Bic pens and like vape cartridges, like disposable vapes. That's all be mine. This is the hill I die on. A hill of just like
of jewel leaking, cartridges.
Yeah, jewel cartridges. Yeah. I'm gonna how about you read this quote, Anna? This is fun.
Yeah, I can do that.
So reading, that's what Anna's going to read to us now from The Technofossil Record, where archaeology and paleontology meet, from the Anthropocene curriculum, which is an extremely attractive website. That it's
really?
They got really great. Yeah, they got really great graphic design. It's very cool.
No, the way you said it, I couldn't tell if it was actually very cool or GeoCities.
No, it's a really, they use that funding well. Okay,
great. Quote, archaeology has a long tradition and practice of collecting, classifying, interpreting, and curating artifacts of all kinds, a tradition almost entirely lacking in geology, except when collaborating with archaeologists, naturally, on Pleistocene and Holocene strata. Wow. This knowledge and experience could usefully inform a paleontologist's approach, whose natural reflex might be to try out Linnaean biological classification on technofossils, placing, for example, a Bic crystal ballpoint pen species within a large and diverse ballpoint pen genus, within a family of pens, including fountain and felt tip pens, within an order of writing implements in which pencils and crayons might be located. All these being within a phylum of communicative technology, which could inspire fierce discussions over whether or not it would include computers and televisions. This is great.
All right.
Who wrote this? So snappy.
We can find out. Yeah.
Such an approach would be fascinating if prone to being instantly overwhelmed by the huge scale and explosive growth of technodiversity. Yeah. Not to mention the cumbersome process of biological taxonomy, which demands the formal selection of type specimens and the involvement of committees in nomenclatural changes for individual species. Yeah, well, that system is from the 1600s, so you know. Taxonomic systems, however, reflect evolutionary patterns, and technofossil evolution differs from biological evolution. End quote.
Yeah, so that's I really love that. I love thinking about that, of like what a technofossil is, and then also thinking about how do we blend archaeology and paleontology in a setting like this, if we're thinking about defining the geological present in the same terms as the geological past requires? Because remember, sort of the scaffolding that I gave to this whole episode is thinking like, well, like, when is it?
Right.
Like, we're getting up to the point of like when it was proposed to, mm-hmm. to like the what the proposal stated versus like what could be successful, or like, and then we'll think like, do we care? Like, I mean, do we care?
I was gonna say, like, at what point is taxonomy even helpful?
Well, no, I'm not talking about a taxonomy. I'm thinking about just like naming, like a cat, like,
oh,
this time. Naming. Like, how do we, like,
do we even need a label? Sure.
Well, yeah. And like how do we, how do we package, like, how do we translate the present into geology, like a geological moment? There's also new types of rock. New type of rock just dropped, Anna.
New rock just dropped?
Yeah, plastiglomerate. Which, huge bummer right here, is formed through intermingling of melted plastic, beach sediment, basaltic lava fragments, and organic debris from Camilo Beach on the island of Hawaii. So it straight up formed a rock. And this is a type of,
that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also really stress inducing graphs like this one that I'm going to have Anna describe to us.
The chart is titled Biomass and Anthropogenic Mass and Estimates Since the Beginning of the 20th Century on a Dry Mass Basis.
So this is comparing all the stuff we made to every living thing on the planet.
Yeah, well, so we start at 1900 with very little.
Yeah.
In dry weight as, what is that, tons?
Teratons.
Teratons. Thousands of tons. Wow. And so in 1900, it's very little. And by 2020, it is off the actual chart. It is, yeah, it is at roughly 1.18 teratons, thousand tons of mass.
That, and that is the amount, that is the biomass that's equal to the,
also sucks.
So by now we have produced more stuff such as metal, asphalt, bricks, aggregates, and concrete, big in the aggregates and concrete. So it's like gravel and concrete.
Well, that makes sense.
Which is
a lot of it. There's as much of that as there is living mass on the planet.
All living mass. That includes every single bug.
It includes
all the blue whales, all the plants, all the worms, everything.
Bacteria and virus, the oldest tree, the biggest tree.
Yep. So for these, does include you. For these and other identified reasons, the Anthropocene Working Group put forward the mid-20th century as the start of this new epoch. So that's what the proposal said, that it was the mid-20th century. In order to convince the wider geological scientific community, they had to find what's called a golden spike, the cuter name for what's technically known as a global boundary stratotype section and point, a GSSP. A golden spike is a marker that can be correlated to contemporaneous sites around the world in diverse environments, and that demonstrates a moment when all systems on Earth tipped into something irreversibly different than what came before it. So, basically, it's when the clock turned over from 11:59 p.m. Holocene to midnight Anthropocene.
Yeah.
So, historically, GSSPs used fossil markers, but as I learned on the FAQ of the Anthropocene Working Group's Anthropocene curriculum site, linked in the show notes, highly recommended, very cool.
I look forward to checking
it out. With limitations, as we'll get into. Don't look through it now. That research is, everybody stop reading. I'm talking to you. That research is moving away from fossils in favor of geochemical markers, particularly for the last 66 million years. So that's the quaternary, right?
Yeah, yeah. The rise of mammals. It's our time.
This is our time. Quoting from the FAQ, The AWG voted in 2016 to decide that the mid-20th century was the most appropriate time for the Anthropocene lower boundary. This great acceleration is visible in sediments through a variety of signals, including radionuclides from the bomb pulse. Nitrogen isotope changes caused by fertilizers, technofossils, urban deposits, persistent organic pollutants, and increased concentrations of heavy metals from industry and jewel pods, my input there. Human driven biotic change, so invasive species and extinctions, traces of fossil fuel extraction and burning, oil spills, and landscapes significantly changed by dams. Of these, the bomb pulse is probably the clearest and most globally synchronous signal, making it the prime candidate marker for the Anthropocene. This does not mean, however, that is the first or even the most significant marker of human impact on the planet. It just best fills the criteria needed for a GSSP, end quote. So, yeah, so I want you to try to hold those reasons in your mind as we as we move into our last section. So did the working group find its golden spike among all the things that transformed in the 20th century? The International Commission of Stratigraphy, whom we mentioned at the very, very top of the last episode, they didn't seem to think so. The mid-20th century was the proposed start time of the formal geological Anthropocene in that vote, which failed, with 66% voting against. Will the decision be appealed or the proposal revised and put to a new vote with perhaps a new date? Or will they pursue the alternate route in which a committee will agree upon a general date following a survey of evidence known as a GSSA, a global standard stratigraphic age? So that's when you take kind of stuff in aggregate rather than like, I found one. But all in good time, I suppose.
I haven't read ahead, so I don't know if I'm sort of jumping the gun here, but the more we kind of get into the process of figuring out when and what, the less I care, and the more it seems to make sense that there should just be sort of generally a record of anthropogenic change, and it doesn't matter when it starts.
Yeah, well... let's keep reading.
Yeah, yeah. Like I said. Anyway, just putting up a little, pin.
And I hope that our listeners are also starting to think of, like, why are we so hung up on a date?
Why? And also, why we're really centering ourselves here, but that's fine. Even if we can't look to the...
Oh, you're like that guy that writes for The Atlantic who was like, the Anthropocene is a joke, and it's just like, you know, it's so hubristic. And then like 2 weeks later, he released a new, this was in 2019, he released a new column called What Changed My Mind About the Anthropocene. And I was just like, oh, The Atlantic. there is an argument that it's just like, we are trying to be the main character as humans by saying that we want to call this a new epic.
The us epic, yeah.
But it also, I hope I've demonstrated so far, we've done enough to change it so fundamentally that it does count. Like, we have.
I'm not saying it doesn't count.
No, but that, it is different. Like, it is different than it has been. But yeah, let's continue and get here in some other voices here.
Even if we can't look to the International Union of Geological Sciences to put a point on when the Anthropocene began, there is another proposed genesis that we should consider, which has possibly been lurking in the shadows through this entire conversation. In 2016, while the Anthropocene Working Group was debating potential golden spikes, scholars Heather Davis and Zoe Todd wrote... Scholars Heather Davis and Zoe Todd wrote in On the Importance of a Date, or Decolonizing the Anthropocene, to be, quote, meant as an intervention into their decision-making process, end quote, which later was published as an article as, quote, a continued intervention to show the political efficacy of placing the GSSP at 1610, end quote.
Yeah. So while the AWG was, you know, in their, like, you know, in that place where they send juries, there's a term for it.
The deliberating room?
No. Like when they were in, like, in session.
I thought the jury's in deliberation.
In deliberation. There we go.
While
we,
in the deliberating
we said the
room.
Deliberation room. And I was like, that's not the term. But
the room where they do the
yes.
thing.
Yeah, I know, right? So while the AWG was in deliberation about when to set it, these two scholars, whose work I really like, they wrote an essay that they sent to them to be like, maybe consider this. And then when they didn't, they moved forward with publishing an article that they expanded upon and folded in the work of other scholars. And it's in the show notes. But yeah.
I love when scholars do that.
Yeah.
Just like, we don't like the way this is going. Let's put out our own material.
You have chosen not to have representation of other ways of knowing, shall we say, other disciplines, other ways of knowing.
We take it upon ourselves to make it available.
And so they were saying, showing the political efficacy of placing the golden spike at 1610.
Mm-hmm. 1610 is known as the Orbis Spike. Sounds cool. Sounds
like no, it's not.
Video.
It's extremely not cool.
It sounds like a dystopian video game boss. First proposed by Simon Lewis and Mark Maslin in 2015. Its name comes from the Latin word for world and correlates with the Columbian Exchange, the colonization processes that kicked off in 1492 and fundamentally altered what humans eat and how they live.
I put that milk toastily.
Yeah.
It's like what we eat and how they live, including whether they do.
Whether they do. Yeah. Sometimes not. A lot of times not.
Yeah.
Corn first appears in European marine sediments. Sorry. Just it sticks around.
No, like pollen. Corn pollen.
I
How about
know.
Corn pollen, not kernels of corn? Anna, this is extremely serious. Please don't make poop jokes.
Corn first appears in European marine sediments dating to 1600, and banana is present in the Americas around then. But, quoting Lewis and Maslin's article in Nature, quote, besides permanently and dramatically altering the diet of almost all of humanity, the arrival of Europeans in the Americas also led to a large decline in human numbers. Regional population estimates sum to a total of 54 million people in the Americas in 1492, with recent population modeling estimates of 61 million people. Numbers rapidly declined to a minimum of about 6 million people by 1650 via exposure to diseases carried by Europeans, plus war, enslavement, and famine. The accompanying near cessation of farming and reduction in fire use resulted in the regeneration of over 50 million hectares of forest, woody savanna, and grassland. End quote. So that regeneration of forest meant carbon uptake, which ultimately led to the atmospheric reduction in CO2. So that regeneration of forest led to carbon uptake because there were more trees, which led to the atmospheric reduction in CO2, global cooling, and the Little Ice Age. Chilly. Davis and Todd write that, quote, the stories we will tell about the origins of the Anthropocene implicate how we understand the relations we have with our surrounds. In other words, the naming of the Anthropocene epoch and its start date have implications not just for how we understand the world, but this understanding will have material consequences that affect bodies and land. That is maybe the most important sentence I've read in a while.
I really recommend you read this article. It's really good. And also... I highly recommend it. I'm pretty sure that there's a open access version available. I don't think I got it through the library. But okay. But yeah, it will be in the show notes.
We can link it. Yeah,
yeah. So this critique which I also think is it really strikes at the heart of like who cares. Truly. Just like, why does this matter? Like, you're getting very hung up on things that aren't what actually is going to affect lives. So this critique reaches back to the development of a concept of an Anthropocene itself. So remember, Crutzen and Stormer had proposed the Industrial Revolution as the period of transition from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. They drew inspiration. What?
Crutzen and Stormer, remind me, it was 2000?
In 2000, they published that essay. That essay where, and so they drew inspiration for this new period of human-driven planetary existence, and they cite this in their essay, from an older concept, the noosphere, which I feel like I've been living in lately, if you pronounce it, no-sphere.
No.
Yeah, so. So in 19, then, so the noosphere, this comes from the Greek word for mind or reason. In 1922, three guys got together in Paris to think big thoughts. They were the French theologian paleontologist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the French mathematician Edouard Leroy, and the Russian geochemist Vladimir Vernadsky. Following this first meeting, they each went on to develop ideas about the impending noosphere. So again, coming from the Greek word for mind or reason. Reason is the important one here, unfortunately. Over the years, they each refined and revisited their ideas, and some quotes from each of their writings, which Anna will read to us, are as follows. From Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, he says,
"Le quote. The idea is that of the earth not only becoming covered by myriads of grains, being covered by myriads of grains.
Yeah, he used it wrong.
Thought.
He used it wrong. Yeah. Myriad, you don't say myriad of, you just say myriad.
Yeah, anyway.
This is a pro tip for everybody trying to sound smart out there.
Also, he's probably writing in French, so maybe he did it right in French.
Well, we'll get to who wrote what I'm quoting from and not including in the show notes. So,
alrighty. The idea is that of the earth not only becoming covered by myriad grains of thought, but becoming enclosed in a single thinking envelope so as to form, functionally, no more than a single vast grain of thought on the sidereal scale. Mm-hmm. The plurality of individual reflections grouping themselves together and reinforcing one another in the act of a single unanimous reflection.
So he's talking about, so this this thinking envelope it works like an atmosphere, but an atmosphere of communication. Remember, this is like in the late 20s, 30s. So an atmosphere of communication, of knowledge, of reason, of enlightenment. And so it's something that some have argued is like the internet kind of thing, like a thinking envelope.
Sure.
And then we have, does that make sense at least? Like what that,
your explanation of what he is saying makes sense.
Okay.
But what he is saying does not make sense.
Word salad. Yeah. So it's this idea, because it's very, but I think you also,
it's big thinky thoughts.
Let's remember that he is a theologian paleontologist.
Yeah.
And he's like in his Tesla bag here. He's doing futurism or something. Then we have from Leroy, who, remember, mathematician.
"We are, in truth, confronting a phenomenon of planetary, perhaps cosmic, importance. This new force is human intelligence." Man, every time dudes get together and say that there's an enlightenment.
They invent eugenics every time.
Every time.
Yeah, well,
it's
I know. This is the
crabs of white people in the sense that evolution tends towards crabs. And unfortunately, white people thinking big thinky thoughts seems to lead towards eugenics.
Yes. Okay, go on.
Sorry. God.
Go on.
"This new force is human intelligence, the reflexive will of humankind. Through human action, the noosphere disengages itself little by little from the biosphere," and becomes more and more independent. And all this with rapid acceleration and an amplification of effects which continue to grow. Correlatively, however, by a sort of return shock, hominization has introduced in the course of life some formidable risks. End quote. Can I say something about that isn't like a man?
Yeah.
Just, it's interesting to me that the mathematician is the one who is kind of thinking in systems, because it's very sort of, you have a system that exists up until it reaches a point of criticality,
yeah,
and then change is affected. Yeah.
And you also see that in Verdansky's. So Verdansky is the one who people really credit with.
As a geochemist. Okay. Yeah. So he's like aware of.
Yeah. So he's the one that is really credited with the noosphere. And so he's talking about this sort of sort of levels. And so you have the geosphere, which is sort of the level of the inanimate. You have the biosphere, which is the living, and the noosphere is the level of consciousness.
Okay.
And so
that at least sort of makes visual sense.
Right? You're like, okay,
fine.
Cool.
I see some nested spheres. Yeah. Great.
And then let's hear what he has to say.
Quote, this new form of biogeochemical energy, which might be called the energy of human culture or cultural biogeochemical energy, is that form of biogeochemical energy which creates at the present time the noosphere.
End quote.
What?
So, so you can see the point where I fell asleep. I have riff on and then nothing. And then I woke up like 2 hours later and I was very sweaty and confused and had strange dreams about this. You know, no, don't say that. So each of these guys saw them in the midst of a transition, this moment of where, I guess like modernity was happening at such a rapid pace that obviously like we were going to break into this new way of being.
To be fair, I can see how in the 20s, the view that things had accelerated and were still accelerating at a new kind of pace,
yeah,
and sort of, yeah, about to be out of control. Well,
yeah. And so thinking about these ideas have persisted and have found new life in another arena. But it's this idea of creating the noosphere that like this is the point where we have changed. Like man, capital M man, has changed. That idea.
Why not put it when we became bipedal? Like what?
Because that doesn't matter to them. Because that didn't make us, that isn't what made us, that didn't give us reason. Remember, we're talking about reason. And so it's this idea that has, that rolls around every so often. And I pulled this from a paper that was written, that was published 4 years ago by the RAND Corporation. And so the RAND Corporation, for those who don't know, started out, it broke off from the U.S. military, or the U.S. I think it was the military and not the government, but it started out as the R&D corporation. So research and development.
Oh, okay.
And so it was an arm of research and development from the military state, up through World War II. And then it broke off to be a quote, independent. And it is one of the earliest think tanks, but it was the first think tank to call itself such and like kind of be like, this is our deal and we love it. And so what the RAND Corporation does is a lot of public sector consulting, a lot of like policy briefings, a lot of research. And they have had a lot of involvement in things like counterterrorism. In U.S. going into various wars like Vietnam and Iraq. They have gone into, they did a big study on like the healthcare industry in the 70s, I think, that gave us what we got now. And so they are nominally nonpartisan. They happen to have a lot of people who have been in the Department of Defense, and sort of points above in the U.S. government. But a big thing they've been doing lately, like in the past 5-6 years, is advising on AI.
I was wondering if this was going to get to AI.
This
here
is,
we are.
So, and that's where we're at again, of this sort of like, we're in the 20s. It feels like things, we're like on the precipice of this huge leap forward. And so this is like people who get weird about transhumanism, and sort of that whole, like the Jim S. Smoots of the world, they like thinking about the noosphere.
Sure.
And so this is, this was a, was this the, was a really tidy paper that just summed up each of those three guys' takes on this topic. That is the same sort of rhizome out of which we have, well, you know, we got the rhizome, it's under the ground and shoots come up.
Ginger root.
So one shoot that comes up is Crutzen and Stormer's essay proposing an Anthropocene on the basis of changes like vast and like staggering changes to the, on a geological scale done by humans, like as identified as happening with the Industrial Revolution, which followed sort of the Enlightenment period, and also thinking about these ideas of like reason and change and flourishing and all these sort of things and where they happen and who they happen to. There's that one that comes up. And then there's another one that comes up later of being like, AI, the singularity, and sort of transhumanism. But which I think is important to consider, sort of the bedfellows of your ideas. But for the rest of our time today together, I want us to think a little bit more about the material consequences of how we understand the world. Like that quote that you read from
like defining how we understand.
Yeah. From that intervention
making categories. Yeah.
And also think about the politics, in a very general sense, that inform and are revealed by these conversations around the Anthropocene that we've discussed these last two episodes. So Davis and Todd discuss the arrival of colonialism to the Americas as they characterize it as a seismic shock. And that's a really useful tool here, because a seismic shock moves through time and space like a slinky, compressing it as it moves longitudinally. There's a link there, Anna, for you to click on, and you'll click on the link and you'll see. This is a GIF from the Exploratorium explaining how earthquakes work. So when you have a slink, when you do the slinky, have you done this before?
I have done it with a slinky, not in any sort of way.
Yeah. So slinkies
like
are
imagining
very,
an earthquake.
Slinkies are very helpful in illustrating seismic waves, because there are a few different types of seismic waves. The most common one is the P wave, the primary wave, and that's what we're talking about here. This sort of seismic shock. You have the shock, the earthquake that feels like a truck driving into the foundation of your building. It's very scary. Several times you feel one, and sometimes after. So you have the shock, which applies the force onto the slinky, and then you see it compress, but it compresses and then widens. And so it widens behind it as the compression moves longitudinally.
Right. So it looks like the little section where the coils of the slinky are closer together are just scooting along the length of the
slinky. It
looks
like they're moving, but what it is it's moving through
the force is moving.
Different rings of the different curves of the slinky.
Which is the seismic wave that is represented by a slinky going down the stairs?
That works like a primary wave because it is moving down. It's moving down and then it's moving down.
And then flip, move down.
But they also, so thinking about that, like let's think about that Davis seismic shock and the sort of moving through time and space as you watch it.
I understand.
They also look to Christina Sharpe's work In the Wake on Blackness and Being. So Sharpe's, which is a also just really good. I find it to be very effective to in like helping understand the concept, conceiving of these things. So Sharpe's engagement with the legacy of chattel slavery. So that is the enslavement and transport of people from Africa to the Americas. That's chattel slavery. She engages with it by thinking of the wake behind a slave ship on the Middle Passage and how the wake formed by the boat moving, those waves reverberate out into the present. And so you have, the trauma that is experienced or that is, made manifest in the present is the same as what happened 500 years ago, but it's moved through time and space and it can build, it can change shape, like it can mount and then it breaks. So it's a wave that breaks.
It's really interesting to think of like trauma as a physical force.
And something that can move through.
It's something that abides by some of the laws of physics.
Yeah. And so thinking about something that also moves. So if you think of each coil of the slinky as a generation, as an individual, as a community, and you see it moving through them, that it fundamentally changes it. But
changes their alignment.
Their experience, their alignment. And if you're feeling this seismic shock moving through you, it has the capacity to level things. They write.
Heck of a metaphor.
Right? Like they're two that work together.
It's good. Yeah. It's a really, really well and correlated.
And they are and looking at the experience of colonization in the Americas and the experience of chattel slavery into the Americas are distinct, but they are intertwined. And so they look to Sharpe's work as a sort of complement or counterpoint to their work. And so they write, quote, this is Davis and Todd write, quote, the Anthropocene, or at least all of the anxiety produced around these realities for those in Euro-Western contexts, is really the arrival of the reverberations of that seismic shockwave into the nations who introduced colonial capitalist processes across the globe in the last half millennium in the first place. Much as Sharpe describes the ongoing wake of slave ships, the seismic shockwave of colonial earth renting is an ongoing epistemic present, and we envision the seismic shockwave as a reckoning, one laying bare the human and environmental injustice of the orders upon which late stage capitalism and white supremacy are built. End quote. So it's this idea of like, it's finally touching us. It's finally touching the scientists who are in that room thinking about, oh, dang, things got pretty bad in the last century. Like, it's catching up. And so this is...
last couple centuries. When did Davis and Todd write this?
So it was 2016, and I think it came out in 2018, 2019 in ACME, the Journal of Critical Geography. But it's... So they're saying... So when the AWG proposed the Great Acceleration in the 20th century, they were saying... No, it wasn't then. That's when you noticed.
That's when the needle went.
Yeah, that's when the wave moved through. And that's when the wave created in the wake lapped onto shore. So the term Capitalocene, was coined first by Jason Moore and Andreas Malm to characterize capitalism and its actions as an ecological force, and to move away from the sense that responsibility for the Anthropocene falls on the anthropoi, humankind. So
you had me and then you lost me.
Okay, so where did I lose you?
No, the idea lost me. Like, move away from the sense that responsibility falls on.
So, because everything we've talked about up to introducing the ideas that I'm quoting, that mm-hmm. I'm sort of drawing from Davis and Todd's work, is saying humans, all of the anthropoi.
Okay, not everybody. Oh, I see.
Changed,
this
like,
is
we
breaking
had,
away
because,
from.
Because they're thinking about that spike and that point where, like, in geological terms, you need to show that everything changed. And so you have right. to make it look like it changed. Like, you have to figure out where it changed. And
okay, so moving away from that idea to.
So thinking about.
It's a smaller portion
yeah,
of.
So saying, the anthropoi. Like, but, you know, okay. 3,000 years ago, you know, okay. it was that maybe that was it. But there were communities. That were neither generating those changes nor feeling any of the effects of those changes, like the benefits or negative. The Industrial Revolution absolutely did not have a universal change, and then also the Great Acceleration. Absolutely did not have, like, sort of who's responsible for it. The parties right. who were responsible for the Industrial Revolution were did have connections to and sort of like were formed like an ancestry of the parties that did the things that caused those anthropogenic changes in the Great Acceleration. So it's this moving away okay. from this idea of like it's not the anthropoi who did it. It's capital.
Not everybody.
And yeah. so it's this pursuit of capital. And so this isn't like the kind of like shortcut, meme-y, like, oh, capitalism is trash kind of idea. This is actually like talking about capital, the pursuit of capital.
Okay.
However, and so it has changed, but it was in place with 1492. It was a pursuit of capital at that point that started the Columbian Exchange. And in some cases, the capital was humans. So in truth, so sort of like if we look at like, you know, if we look at the data here, in the 350 years between the Orbis spike and the bomb spike, the majority of anthropogenic markers in the geological record that we've discussed here are the result of a very, very small percentage of humans and intimately tied to the pursuit of capital.
Okay.
And so in the process, claims were staked, land was transformed, boundaries were drawn, and wars were waged. So David Ruccio writes, quote, "Capitalocene points to the ways capitalism, the particular tendencies and dynamics associated with the appropriation and distribution of surplus value, the accumulation of capital, and much else, has both made the despoiling of the natural environment, examples given through the use of fossil fuels, central to the production and distribution of commodities, and shifted its effects onto poor people and minorities, who bear higher levels of water, air, and other kinds of pollution than anyone else," end quote. So does that definition
yeah,
of capitalism that, make
yes.
sense? Of mm-hmm. that you want more value, you want as much value for as least stuff, which is not a like natural law, like that profit motive, that seeking to profit. So that brings us to another symptom of the Capitalocene, if we want to call it that, worth mentioning, climate skepticism. Work like that, so that's the people who are like, well, you know, it was cold, like it snowed
just
in Texas, therefore, yeah. So mm-hmm. work like that, a historian of science, Naomi Oreskes, has demonstrated that the jury isn't out on climate science. You'll hear that discussed in the media and like in Congress and in other spaces of like public opinion. There is scientific consensus, just as there are concerted efforts made to obscure the existence of that consensus for the benefit of capital and to the detriment of the planet, especially the most dispossessed communities that call it home, the global poor. So quoting Oreskes,
quote, this analysis shows that scientists publishing in the peer-reviewed literature agree with IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the National Academy of Sciences, and the public statements of their professional societies. Politicians, economists, journalists, and others may have the impression of confusion, disagreement, or discord among climate scientists, but that impression is incorrect. The scientific consensus might, of course, be wrong. If the history of science teaches us anything, it is humility. And no one can be faulted for failing to act on what is not known. But our grandchildren will surely blame us if they find that we understood the reality of anthropogenic climate change and failed to do anything about it.
End quote.
Oh, sorry. End quote.
Yeah.
I got stuck thinking about it. I was like, that's really good. I forgot to say end quote.
So and also like as I was working on this and I was like really getting a lot out of it, I was just like, oh, maybe it's like cool that I'm entering a PhD in like the history and philosophy of sociology of science. And just like because I'm thinking about like so many of like the most resonant authors that we've talked about that we've cited are people that work in that sphere. So,
I think I've figured out why our dynamic is works so well for this show and why it's what parts we bring. I'm really good at knowing tiny tidbits. You're really good at thinking about stuff.
Thinking and like knowing. That'll be our elitist show. Thinking and knowing.
I don't want that. I'm always just really floored by how insightful and like complete your thought processes are. Well, and I'm just like,
no, and that is like this. I am a conduit for other people's insights and completion of thoughts.
But you understand them and explain them in depth, and I really appreciate that.
I hope that it's feeling accessible. Okay, thank you. Gosh. So maybe one can argue that it's not the place of geological sciences to care about politics or power relations, but I would tell one that they are wrong. So for those of us brought up in that very universalizing colonial framework or who are unfamiliar with the work like that upon which Davis and Todd built their article, this topic is a really unique opportunity to chip away at the foundations of our thinking. In exploring conversations around the Anthropocene, we observe knowledge creation in action and see that science isn't apolitical. Universalizing the issue by saying this is the issue of the anthropoi downplays the harm done to the most impacted, who almost invariably see the least benefit of the processes at play. It dilutes culpability for those driving ecocide and genocide, or what Kim Tallbear calls a genocide that, quote, included and includes and continues to include our other than human relatives, end quote. So ecocide and genocide are the same thing, and smears responsibility around to us all. If anybody wants my opinion, I like the idea of calling this moment the Capitalocene because it implies not only a lower boundary at its start, but an upper boundary at its end, which will be followed by something else. I like that. That gives me hope that by calling this something, because every other epoch has ended and another one has followed. And so perhaps we are in the Anthropocene, but by being in the middle of it, we're not able to see what makes for an obvious golden spike as required by geological scientific consensus. And so maybe we should consider whether epic transitions were quite so simultaneous on a geological scale. Like when we look into the past, with very few exceptions, are we able to say, like, well, in March, this happened. And in June, 3 years later, this happened. Like, we don't see that. Like, we don't see centuries in a lot of archaeological contexts in, like, the deeper past. Like when you think about like Neolithic populations or Denisovan populations, you don't see a couple, like you don't see a couple generations. You may see them, but you don't know, like you don't know, you don't know that tight, that you don't know these the granularity of time that we're talking about here. By being in the midst of something very consequential and very, very real, but witnessing that we can't come to some kind of epistemic consensus, like we can't decide what it is, we're being shown the limits of Western science's utility. Through those cracks, though, we have a chance to glimpse other forms of knowledge, other forms of being, and other forms of philosophy. And I find that tremendously hopeful.
Yeah.
And so yeah. I'd like to end with a call to arms, or perhaps a call to tendrils, from Donna Haraway. I am calling all this the Cthulhu scene, past, present, and to come. These real and possible time spaces are not named after science fiction writer H.P. Lovecraft's misogynist racial nightmare monster Cthulhu, note the spelling difference, but rather after the diverse earthwide tentacular powers and forces and collected things with names like Naga, Gaia, Tongaroa, Burst from Waterfall Papa, Terra, Hanayasu Hime, Spider Woman, Pachamama, Oya, Gorgo, Raven, Aakulu Jusi, and many, many more. My Cthulhu scene, even burdened with its problematic Greek-ish tendrils, entangles myriad temporalities and spatialities and myriad interactive entities in assemblages, including the more than human, the other than human, the inhuman, and the human as humus. Even rendered in an American English language text like this one, Naga, Gaia, Tongaroa, Medusa, Spider-Woman, and all their kin are some of the many thousand names proper to a vein of science fiction that Lovecraft could not have imagined or embraced. Namely, the webs of speculative fabulation, speculative feminism, science fiction, and scientific fact. It matters which stories tell stories, which concepts think concepts. Mathematically, visually, and narratively, it matters which figures figure figures, and which systems systemize systems. And which systems systematize systems, end quote. So, Haraway provides what I find to be a very affecting counterproposal to the inherently eugenicist greenwashy calls to limit overpopulation, chiefly among the global poor. The work done like the Gates Foundation and like these sort of these ideas of like that they target populations. Instead, she calls for kin making. Kind of speaking back to that idea of how the global population swelled from 3 to 6 billion people and then continues. But she doesn't want to limit overpopulation. She's not working in that framework. She says, quote, over a couple hundred years from now, maybe the human people of this planet can again be numbered 2 or 3 billion or so, while all along the way being part of increasing well-being for diverse human beings and other critters as means and not just ends. So make kin, not babies. It matters how kin generate kin. End quote.
Yeah. We have a shared human past, a shared human present, and
we have a shared human future, but that doesn't mean that we have a shared degree of responsibility. And so for those of us who are in a position of benefiting more than we contribute, rather than the folks that are at the other end that neither benefit nor contribute, but suffer the greatest, like we have a different responsibility, but we also don't need to be taking, like, we don't need to be quite so concerned about our plastic straws when like all the straws that we could ever use in sort of these sort of campaigns and bans and things like that. It means it's nothing compared to the pursuit of capital. And so that is, but that also by taking away that universal responsibility, we also are allowing ourselves to be less fatalist. And we don't see like, oh, this is just how it's going and how it will be. It's like there is a better world is possible. And so we just need to, like, this is a, like, I found this script comforting because it is this opportunity to determine, you know, which stories tell stories and which concepts think concepts.
Yeah. And I think really importantly, you know, the question that kind of kicked us off was, is this the Anthropocene? Does it matter? And I think the process of coming up with a label, the label itself doesn't matter. I think the reflexive acts of kind of analyzing what got us to the point of calling whatever span of time the Anthropocene, I think that the thought and scholarship that came out of that is what's valuable. I don't care what we call it. I don't.
Yeah, it's the question.
We don't think about. And so, you know, you said you wrote these episodes in an effort to zoom out from thinking about individual lives, but actually the where we've sort of ended our narrative is zooming back in from conceiving these like sort of vast spans of geologic time as sort of important and needing to be categorized so we can understand them, and kind of zooming back into the individual human life and saying, well, you know, in the scheme of thinking of ourselves as differently responsible mm-hmm. members of an interconnected kind of kinship system globally.
And so if we think about if we do a bit of in reach here for me personally, and thinking about how this was a move motivated by grief and this desire to like mm-hmm. lose myself and to lose my like own pain and my own loss and just sort of that and like incredible like ephemerality of life. By zooming out onto a geological scale and thinking about us at that yeah. level.
No, you've done that.
What
absolutely.
I've come back to is this idea that the only reason why this geological time that we're debating matters is because of the people that occupy it. Like the only yeah, reason why it's come up at all is because some people did this. Some people are like some people are have been sort of eliminated, like have been like crushed out of existence. They've never been given a chance to exist, but so many have, and there are so many that we need to think of to come. And so like I think that's part of that hopeful aspect of yeah. You know, it's all, you know, talking about like grains of thought here. Like it's, you know, got to move away from this like very like sort of dripping with enlightenment kind of chauvinistic idea of
yeah.
of like time and space and the future and look to these thinkers and these thoughts and these sort of concepts that are born out of resistance and resilience, and I think that it's tremendously hopeful to look to that.
Yeah,
and so I hope that folks feel similarly. And
I learned so much, I am grateful to have the button on all of that be a hopeful.
Yeah.
One, it's a lot to process, but processing is kind of incentivized if I know that it comes around to sort of yeah. a hopeful reward.
Yeah,
at the end yeah. of all that thinking. Yeah. Well, what a good job, bud.
Oh,
and I don't mean that. I'm not patronizing at all. Like, I really, really appreciate this. This is. I feel enriched. I spend non-chauvinistically enlightened
week working on this, so just like sort of being alone and morose.
Okay, well, not house. That, but I can tell
it was like it was like a series of like stills from the El Chapo, not the El Chapo show, Narcos from Narcos. Where
I was gonna say, was it Narcos?
It wasn't El Chapo. It was like Narcos, where he just like looks sad around. He just like that actor like manages just to like
Pedro Pascal.
No, Pedro.
I was gonna say, like, did he show up? I didn't. Naomi watch Narcos. I didn't.
So the first season of Narcos is on. My God. Well, what's the guy's name?
Pablo Escobar.
No. Yes. Yeah. Right. No? I was trying to think of the actor. Yeah. So talking about Pablo Escobar and like, so I was trying to remember the name. It's like a Brazilian actor and he's very talented. So there are all of these scenes of him just like looking sad and schlubby and just like him like sitting on a bench, like him sitting at the tables. And it was like that. I just sat various spots around my house looking sad and reading really incredible work. And it was nice.
Wagner Moura.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah.
You tried.
Yeah. So thanks for coming along.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for doing this. And
yeah. Thanks for being listeners.
If you want to appreciate Amber like I do and send her some love, thedirtpodcast@gmail.com.
Or just vibes. I receive vibes. Or just vibes.
Yeah. No, my goodness. The vibes antenna are just out. Wheelie-wee. And just going wheelie-weep, wheelie-weep, wheelie-weep. No, but I just, I hope that you are getting appreciative vibes from me and from our listeners in the future. Because this was a really good one.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming along. Please do read what's in the show notes, and I'm not going to include the paper from the Rand Corporation. So
no, don't bother with that one. Oh, it was the airport. It was a airplane wing of the military, not necessarily the Air Force, but the Douglas Air Corporation is what Rand split off from.
Okay. Yeah.
And also, I did some light Googling and, Ferb Hankbert is in fact a shout out to Frank Herbert.
Okay, well, good. I'm glad that you. But it's also just
I just wanted Ferb. To know, yeah, okay, and now fine. My brain's not stuck, and that's not like pinging off the sides loudly anymore.
I mean, I'm still thinking Ferb about Hankbert. Vampires. And
Ferb
love.
Hankbert, turn around.
So the person singing that "Turn Around" is one of the writers of the song, who like pitched it to Bonnie Tyler.
Kind of hoping you were going to say Meatloaf, but it's not.
No.
No, sadly. Cool. Well, going to have to leave all of that in the Eclipse episode so that this makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Everybody, well, take care of each other.
Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And tell the people in your life that you care about them.
I care
while
about you,
while you still can. So.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
We love you. Goodbye.